listening to 1 in 10 from National Children's Alliance. I'm Teresa Wezar, your host. Join us as we engage in one-on-one conversations with the brightest minds in science, medicine, faith, communications, and the law. We'll discuss the path forward to solve the greatest challenge 1 in 10 of our children face, child abuse. Today's episode is This is a Marathon, Not a Sprint, Pacing Yourself Through a Pandemic. Child protection professionals have tough jobs on any day. Add in a pandemic and you're piling stress on top of stress. How do wear and tear of fear and anxiety affect us at work and at home? How do we cope with the ever-present feeling that we're not doing enough? I invited Françoise Mathieu, Executive Director of the Tent Academy and an expert on high-stress workplaces, to walk us through ways of coping with working through a pandemic. What's a healthy response? Why should we stop saying, well, when things go back to normal? And how can we care for ourselves and our colleagues while keeping our distance? One of the things that I was really have been struck by is, you know, when we first talked about a year ago, of course, we had no idea that we'd be facing a pandemic at this point. But when you watch the nightly news, when you listen to NPR or BBC, what are you really struck by and what are you reflecting on these days?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. So, Teresa, I like to kind of weave between the personal and the professional observations, if you don't mind. And
Sure. One
of the things that I was really struck by, and I'm including myself in this, is kind of the level of denial that we all had and that we used as a coping mechanism, if you will. So I was actually in Asia for all of January. I was traveling with my daughter. She's going to law school in the fall. So it was kind of our, you know, our mother-daughter trip. And we were in Japan and Vietnam and Singapore and Korea. And we were literally like a week before it all started. You know, it was kind of like we were chasing COVID, if you will.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting experience for me to start absorbing what was going on there. And yet, even though all of that was happening, I still was in an incredible state of denial. Like I came home and it never really occurred to me that it could happen here in that way. And I'm using that example as a way for all of us to really have a lot of self-compassion towards ourselves about rumination, right? Shoulda, coulda, woulda, like, because a colleague of mine called this a black swan event, you know, that there's some things we just can't fully process or prepare for. And so I think that that's the part that I was observing as, you know, this was unfolding. And then of course, when it all dropped or all landed on us, I think all of us had to deal with some pretty basic trauma. Like just the impact was, you know, it was a shared traumatic event that in Canada, March 11th was the day here where there was a before and an after. And so that was one piece I observed. The other thing, and we can talk more about that because it's going to weave into coping strategies, but I find that the media, some of them are doing a really good job and some of them I'm concerned by how the coverage is potentially really negatively impacting people's mental health, but we can talk more about that.
Well, let's just sort of dive into that a little bit, because I think that one of the things that I've been reflecting about myself has been the sort of fear and generalized anxiety and exhaustion, you know, that you see in these images, which is real. You know, we feel that, others feel that, those who are in the epicenters or hotspots certainly are experiencing that even more than most, but at the same time, I do wonder what it is when we're constantly exposed to those images and sounds, as we're obsessively watching the news and listening to media accounts. You know, how is that impacting our own mental health? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And as you know, I was doing a webinar for NCAC on Tuesday, and we were talking about how, of all the professions in the world, I mean, we better than anyone know about trauma and secondary trauma, right? We know about it in our work. And yet it's almost like as if we lost touch with the fundamentals of what we know. And so one of the really important messages I'm trying to convey is that although this is, of course, an unprecedented event in its scale, We have over 40 years of research about how to manage traumatic events. And there are some things that we clearly know about how it impacts us and the people we serve. And one of the concerns that I'm having, which is why, as you've seen, I've been doing a lot of writing and providing a lot of tools recently.
Yeah.
I have real concerns about, first of all, how is wear and tear and fatigue and anxiety impacting our decision-making ability, our ability to think clearly, how it's impacting our relationships with others at home and at work, and how, in turn, is it impacting the really critical work that your folks do? And I think that we need to go back to the basics. So can I give you an example?
Sure.
So one of the things that I observed, and you know, I have this meta-awareness because this is what I do for a living and I do this full time. I always have this kind of self-awareness of observing myself going, you know, through things. Does that make sense? Like I'm experiencing them, but I'm also going, huh, you know, interesting. So I'm sure many of you can relate to this. When this first went down, what I experienced for the first 3 to 5 days was totally normal, you know, hyper arousal, going into this mode of survival, right? And so the first thing I needed to do is I needed to make sure that my people were safe. I had to, you know, extract my daughter's partner was trapped in Mexico. I had to kind of get him out, you know, before the borders closed. I had to repatriate my son from college. Like I had to make sure that the fundamentals were covered so that I could go back to the work that I have and I could think clearly. And so I think we need to, first of all, secure the foundations, physical and mental health for ourselves. That's the first place. And the other piece is that in the people who are listening to this podcast, some of you are in a different place than you were maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago emotionally. Maybe you're feeling better. Some of you are not. Some of you are still feeling very dysregulated because maybe things are not actually a-okay. You know, maybe you have sick relatives or someone close to you, you know, is immunocompromised. Maybe you're working from, maybe you're actually not working from home right now. Maybe you're still in the field or your loved ones are. Also, maybe you're not working from this, you know, lovely, quiet house. Maybe the whole bunch of people stuffed inside this house, you know? So I think we really first need to go back to the fundamentals before we can get to sophisticated level thinking. And the piece about consuming media constantly is the same message I would have given to all of you a year ago about consuming trauma material after work. You know, remember we talked a lot about, does it make sense to do this work and then go and watch 3 hours of Law and Order at the end of the day or Forensic Files? How are we resetting our nervous system? Those lessons still are true right now, because although we need to be informed, I don't think that we need to be informed in the volume and the, you know, I think that there's a lot you can know from one reliable news source or two by checking it once a day, as opposed to constantly.
Well, and you know, it's one of those things where, you know, aside from the sort of obsessively checking, one of the things that I've been thinking about, you know, I have CAC colleagues who I'm Facebook friends with and watching their posts. And I think there's a deep sense right now of constantly feeling like, what, you know, you're not enough. You know, no matter what you're doing, how much you're doing, how much you're juggling, the fact that as a CAC leader, or other child abuse professional, you're taking care of your family, you're trying to take care of your staff, you're trying to take care of yourself. And this feeling of you can't possibly meet all those needs and be enough. And the guilt, the feelings of guilt that sort of reside in that. And I was thinking in particular about a friend who was posting about, you know, she's so concerned about her child not getting behind in school that essentially she's teaching him all day and working all night and getting 2 or 3 hours of sleep in the wee hours of the morning. And that's really driven by this sense of anything I could possibly do cannot possibly be enough to meet the need. And so everyone is feeling that to some degree and some more than others. Could you just talk about, you know, how do we transition away from being so guilt-driven, essentially, in the choices we're making towards something else?
Oh, this is such a great question. And I actually wrote a couple of articles in the last couple of weeks. And one of them is called, "This is a Marathon, Not a Sprint." And I think that I too have seen that. I've seen, and this is all coming from very well-meaning places, right? The desire.
Of course.
Really conscientious. And so I think we need to break that down a little bit. So the first piece, if we look at the personal stuff first, and then we look at the work, if you have children in your home, one of the things that we all know, and you folks know this better than anyone, is what your children need right now is a parent that is present and calm and loving. Right? So the core curriculum stuff, I've been seeing some folks writing about, can we just stop with the core curriculum, making sure, you know, what our kids need right now is actually to feel loved and safe. Right? Like the kind of this idea that you have to go through the worksheets and go, like, I think that it's like we've lost perspective on, you know, not to minimize that. And I know some kids have, you know, some learning disabilities and you have concerns about that, but really that's not about getting in some huge fight with your children about getting through the worksheets while you're trying to do a conference call. Like if this is a marathon and not a sprint, we need to find a different way to get through this because we don't know how long this is going to last. And we need to have a new normal so that we can be present for our loved ones, but also not burn out. The other piece, as you're saying, is I've heard a lot about guilt, of course, and we have a lot of moral distress around, particularly in the CAC world, you know, people knowing full well that if the calls are down, it's not because the incidence rates are down. Like, there's so many complex layers to the work that you do in particular, but it's not sustainable for us to be. I spoke to someone yesterday or 2 days ago who's in a leadership role, and she said she's doing Zoom calls 12 hours a day till her eyes hurt. You know, it wasn't sustainable before and it's not sustainable now. And if you go and read the first part of my article, This is a Marathon, Not a Sprint, I use a story from a cautionary tale of an event that you may recall that happened during Hurricane Katrina in one of the hospitals in New Orleans. And it's actually really interesting because this investigative journalist, who's also a physician, she actually won a Pulitzer Prize for this book and this article, she compared two hospitals side by side in New Orleans. One of them, they both experienced the same thing, right? Everyone knows what happened during Katrina. One of them, things went terribly wrong. And there were lots of deaths. And like, it was the worst possible case scenario. And the hospital next door, very few people died and there were no weird ethical breaches, you know, and it's so interesting to see what was it about that hospital where things actually didn't go fall off the rails. And what was identified there is there were many elements, and these are really lessons learned. I really believe in looking at, you know, best practices. But what they had done is they had ensured that people still kept to their shifts, right? You weren't just working 24 hours a day. You had time on, time off, even though they were actually all sleeping in the hospital at this point. They had strong leadership. They had good communication. They didn't allow rumors. You know, they just created a structure, like a command structure, that allowed people to sustain themselves. And I think that's such an important message for all of us, particularly those who work in the CAC world. I can't overstate that enough.
Oh, I think it's so true that people are craving, kids at home, and I think employees at work are craving a sense of structure, and also that their leaders are calm.
Yes.
And have a sense of ability to reflect on what's going on, to pause long enough to think about what next steps should be, and then to take those steps. One of the things that you touched on, though, and I kind of want to come to this because I think it's at the center of what many child abuse professionals are experiencing right now, which is it's not that they are occasionally or even once a day facing moral dilemmas. They're facing them all day long. Mm-hmm. And for every child who is referred to them, they're having to make a decision about, do we postpone the services for that child, knowing that something could happen in the interim, mm-hmm. To that child? Do we intercede immediately, knowing that that could introduce COVID-19 into their family, to the child or to the staff or to the MDT member that could be put at risk? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, so it's this constant state of wrestling with risk and with difficult moral choices in which there's no perfect choice, right? There's no choice that doesn't involve any risk to anyone. And can you talk a little bit about how we taught to staff members and team members about working in a circumstance in which all choices are difficult, all choices are bad, all options are not optimal, mm-hmm. And one feels personally responsible in many ways for what will happen as a result of those choices?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think what you're describing is something that in the CAC world was already, all of those elements were already present, but now it has been amplified, right? It has been amplified to, you know, 11, to use that old trope, right? Moral distress was already present, you know, not enough resources, you know, fundamental, sometimes disagreements with regulations, rules, policies, and procedures. I mean, all in a way, what I've been thinking about a lot in the last month is that we were already extremely stressed organizations, right? We already had not enough resources. We had compromised service providers who maybe were struggling. Like, all of that was already present. And it's a little bit like if we look at the parallel with the healthcare system, it's not as if this hit and a very well-functioning healthcare system had to face it, right? This is showing all the cracks that were already there in supply chain, in service provider, you know, provider capacity. So what we're really seeing is an amplification of all of those in a way that, yes, is significant. And the thing that's tricky about moral distress, and I want to talk about moral injury in a minute, but what's tricky about moral distress is that there is no great fix to it, right? There is no one, it's not like other factors where I could say, do these three things, it's going to help. The thing that we know about moral distress is that there are often no good solutions or no good outcomes. But what we do know is in order to support one another through moral distress, we need social support and we need the ability to debrief and vent and be able to have a community of practice where we can say, this feels terrible, or I feel helpless. We need to be able to have that. And when we're not in the office together, we need to create those opportunities. But, you know, I want to go back to someone that you know well, who I have so much respect for, and that's Linda Cordisco Steele, who all of you probably know is one of the top forensic interviewers, really, in the nation. And I had the privilege of having lunch with her, I think a year or two ago at Symposium. And I really wanted to know, what sustains her? What sustains someone like that? And what I'm always looking for are mentors. You know, in every field that I go to and I meet people who are balanced and they're well, even though they're doing difficult work, I always want to talk to them about that. What do you do? And I'll never forget what she said to me at the time. And she said, you know, I do three things. She said, number one, she said, I practice yoga 6 days a week, rain or shine, right? To reset my nervous system. Number two, she said, I'm a really good trainer, and I know that by being a good trainer, I can build capacity and feel that I'm putting, you know, like people out there are going out with the tools they need to do really good work. But the third thing that stayed with me is she said then, and it's still true now, I will never be able to see and you know, interview all the kids. Never. Right? We will never be done. And she said, I need to be able to stay grounded and know that the one person that I'm, you know, working with in this moment, I'm doing the absolute best that I can with all my skills and tools that I can, but we will never be able to help all the kids. But that was also true before. Now it's just on steroids. And we know, of course, there's so many barriers, as you were referring to, in terms of COVID. You know, are we even able to access, you know, go to the homes? No, we can't. We have to have these distancing, you know, the resources are down. And we need to be able to talk to one another about that so that we can grieve, because this is also a grieving process right now.
You know, I'm so glad that you brought up grief, because I think it's the element of it that we haven't thought about aside from, you know, the most obvious, which is there are people who have passed and are lost to us. And of course, you know, we're grieving for them, but we're also grieving for something else, you know, for the sense of normalcy that we had before, for the level of social support that was more easily available to us. And what are you advising teams and leaders around that grief and addressing it?
Oh, it's such a good question. I think that one of the pieces that we need to all wrap our heads around, and when I say it, sometimes people have a reaction that, you know, makes them feel discouraged, but I really don't mean it that way. I feel like we need to stop looking back to, I think we need to stop saying, you know, when things go back to normal, you know, like kind of this idea that this is just a bad dream. I'm not saying that, I'm not being doom and gloom and saying, you know, it's all going to be terrible, but the way we used to do things have changed, you know, not unlike 9/11, right? 9/11 had a profound change on so many aspects, just let alone, you know, travel and security and hypervigilance. And so basically this is a sentinel event for sure. This is, there's a before and an after for everyone. And, you know, just like if you'd spoke to your grandparents about before the Second World War versus the other, right? They were never the same again for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think that, so that's part of the grief, right? Part of the grief is that we're not necessarily going back, but there are things that are shifting that when we can, you know, deal with the pandemic and, you know, all the elements that are health related, that there is something ahead that is shifting, but we want to be part of that process. So I think if I can talk a little bit about leadership, we actually did an interview that's on our website with my colleague, Dr. Patricia Fisher, a couple of weeks ago. And I really recommend leaders go and check it out. You know, it's called Leaders Are People Too. And I think that as leaders, we are powerful role models. We are powerful role models to our folks. So as you were saying yourself, we need to stay calm. We need to be clear-headed, which means we can't be working 18 hours a day. That's just not sustainable. I personally don't want a leader that hasn't slept. You know what I'm saying? Like
want
someone who's well. And then some of the things we recommend is that it's really important that communication be clear and consistent, even though we're dealing with changes, you know, constant changes. So an example I have a friend who works in a hospital in children's mental health, and she was expressing frustration because the messages from up on high contradicted each other, you know, every 10 minutes. You know, it was like, do this. Oh, never mind. Don't do that. Don't. And that's okay because we are not necessarily dealing with all the information. So I always recommend, you know, provide consistent messaging, regular updates, but also if you don't know, just be honest about the fact that, you know, you don't have the answer, but you're going to be looking into it for folks so that they feel, we're designing a webinar right now called Steady at the Helm. We need to feel that our leaders are in charge and in control. So if I can just give a Canadian example, one of the things that's been really interesting is that some of the messaging we've received from our politicians has been very consistent across the nation. And that provides a lot of a real sense of calm, you know, that you kind of know that people, you know, are kind of in charge, but they're thinking clearly, but that's not always the case.
Oh, we could give a number of examples where that's not the case. And I think that, you know, when you look across America, you know, one of the things that our CACs are really experiencing is, you know, not every state has a stay-at-home order even yet. And so our CACs are operating in a variety of environments, everything from those that are largely in lockdown to those who, you know, have instituted, not the CACs themselves, but state government have instituted few areas of guidance, I guess I would say, for the public. And I think that that itself has made it more challenging for CACs, specifically in states that do not have stay-at-home orders, to try to figure out what is the right thing to do, you know, when it's not clear from your own state government leadership what that thing should be. You know, one of the things I also want to ask you about is social distancing is so important right now. You know, we do have to keep this physical separation between ourselves and other people in order to keep them safe and ourselves safe. But I've been sort of noodling around on this idea of how we can maintain this social distance, which is going to be needed for, you know, a period of time that's longer than we want to think, I'm afraid, mm-hmm. but come to that in an open-hearted way where we're not putting up these walls and barriers emotionally between people. And you sort of see this, you know, I was talking to a friend who grew up in Boston, and, you know, she's always said that Washington, D.C. is a much friendlier city. And she said, you know, it's interesting. Since the social distancing has begun, I feel like I'm back in Boston. Mm. You know, the sense of this unfriendly distance between myself and others. And so I'm wondering about, you know, when we think about our colleagues, which are really our work family, and we think about our loved ones, and we think about our neighbors, how do we maintain this physical distance that we need to have for safety, but remain really open-hearted and not having this emotional distance that can sometimes go with it, I think.
I completely agree with you. And I think that, again, this is about kind of the new normal, about making sure that we bring back some practices that maybe we all got really busy and we stopped. Well, I'll just be honest, like this is certainly my personal foible that, you know, when I was really busy, I was traveling extensively. When I got back home, I didn't necessarily put in the time and effort that I used to put into maybe making a quick phone call or FaceTime with loved ones. You know, I was kind of like, right? And what I certainly have found is that, just before we recorded this, I just had a lovely FaceTime chat with one of my best friends. And I think that putting in the time to reach out and connect, you know, I saw my neighbor the other day and we just had a long distance porch chat about checking in with one another. When I go for walks, I try to make sure that I actually, especially if they're elderly folks that are across the street, I always wave at them or smile. Sometimes I smile back, sometimes I don't, but I'm really trying to, if I go to the grocery store, I always ask the cashier, how are you holding up? You know, are people being kind to you? Like that doesn't cost me anything, right? And we know that we are social animals and that we need connection and contact. But I agree with you that I saw a shift as the rules rolled out here, because it's like everywhere else, you know, one day, new rule, less of this.
Sure.
I saw a shift in people's level of tension. So the grocers at the bank, at the post office, I saw people become more tense and more fearful, right? I really sense that. And I think that there are so many ways in which we can just be our own agent of kindness and compassion through that. So one of the things that I've been making sure I do is checking in with, you know, we're talking a lot about social distancing. But I think one of the things we forget is that some of your folks in the states where they are in the stay home order, some of your staff are home alone. Like they're not
in
a house full of cats and dogs and children. They're by themselves. And what's that like? So as hard as it can be to trying to homeschool and deal with all of that, what is it like to be someone who's single? And now they're really isolated. So one of the things I recommend and I've been trying to do is kind of creating a mental list of my more isolated friends. Does that make sense? Like kind of reaching out and connecting with them on a regular basis so that we can support one another through this, because we do have the mediums to do it, right? I mean, you and I are talking right now through Zoom. So just making sure that we, social support is everything.
Well, and it's so interesting, you know, what you were commenting before about this also as an opportunity, because like you, you know, normally my siblings and I, we often, you know, spend most of our communication is through Facebook Messenger. It's not necessarily on the phone, right? We're constantly sending each other things or, you know, chatting through there, but not necessarily taking the time to pick up on the phone. But tonight we're having a virtual happy hour together among all the siblings. And so I think, you know, it's a nice reminder that while this is a terrible situation, it also is an opportunity being home more in order to slow down and do some of those things after the workday that can, you know, reconnect emotionally with people who maybe, to be honest, when I reflect on my own behavior, maybe I've not done enough of previously. Yeah. And so not that I have to carry around guilt, instead I can translate that into some kind of action to say, you know what? How hard would it be to get them on FaceTime or whatever and for us to just catch up?
Well, you know, it's funny because my brother, although he's on furlough right now, but my brother was or is, whatever, a vice president of Cirque du Soleil. So he was obviously a very busy guy. I love him dearly. And, you know, he's one of my best friends. But I used to probably have a chat once every 3 months and we had to schedule it very carefully, like a military operation, you know, make sure we're both around. And we were joking that we're actually doing a little bit of kind of volunteer work together right now. We're just working on something, but I've had a chance to talk to him, you know, almost every day in the last 3 weeks, and I love him.
Oh, I love it
dearly. And we were both saying how sweet that is. But I want to pick up on something else you were mentioning that I think is really important as we, you know, go through this marathon. I think it's really important to bring back some structure and some scheduling into our days and into our lives. So, for example, today in Canada is Good Friday. Well, it's Good Friday everywhere, but Good Friday is a national holiday in Canada, regardless of your religious affiliation. Closed, it's a national holiday. And some of the folks I was talking to were saying, well, like, why don't we just keep working? Because we're just home anyways. And I was like, hang on. So with my team, I had a little chat with them and I said to them, first of all, personally, you know, as an employer, you absolutely are entitled to this day off and I encourage you to take the day off. However, for some of them, what they were saying is if they were actually alone at home, that was facing now like a 3 or 4 day weekend alone without work. And so actually that doesn't feel good. And I said, so just do whatever works for you. But as a leader, the message is you are absolutely entitled and I encourage you and I will not be emailing you stuff. Like you are not going to hear from me work-wise. You structure it however you want. But I also think that it's important because a lot of us are working from home to have rituals where you end your day. And so I have a ritual and it's very simple, right? But every day at 5 o'clock, like we're done, close the laptop and I light a candle. That's it. That's it. Just light a candle. For me, it's this ritual of transitioning to now it's the evening and I might actually be alone all evening and nothing's changed. You know, I might've just literally just moved from one couch to another, but I think that those rituals and transition rituals, they were important before. They're more important now than ever.
I think that's so true. You know, I was talking to someone because I'm not a person who's terribly fond of telework. You know, I prefer to go into the office actually. And so I was talking about my own transition, you know, to becoming a full-time remote worker and the fact that it felt like the days ran together and that honestly the weekends initially did not feel any different from the week and that I had to actually stop myself and reflect on that. Like, is that how I normally live? No. So why am I doing this right now and letting this all run together? You know, but I think we forget that, right? That that the work day provides a certain amount of structure. And if the work day is going to be different, then we're going to have to reimpose structure on that so that we aren't just continuously working every time we think of something, you know, that we're sitting back down at the computer again, sort of obsessively, because I don't think that that's healthy.
Well, it's also, I agree completely with you, Teresa, but I also think in addition to that, it is not sustainable. We need to go back to the basics of neurophysiology. And folks, if you're interested and you go read my article, This is a Marathon, Not a Sprint, I start with a story that all of you know. If you've ever watched, you know, the movie Apollo 13, you remember the time where at some point, basically, you know, the ship is like the air system, like they're all going to die. The astronauts are going to die unless they the engineers at NASA problem solve with, you know, very little time, this filter that they can only put together with whatever's on the spaceship. That ability, like those engineers could not have done that without lots of training, but also they can't do that without having slept or thought or had food. Like we need to be able to retain the ability to think clearly. And we all know, one of the things I've observed is that I'm not as productive as I used to be. And that's completely normal. I know the neuroscience behind it, which helps me, right? To say, huh, but I'm more productive this week than 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, at 2 p.m., I was toast. And I talked to a friend of mine who's a neuroscientist, and she's like, of course, you know. And so I think that reconnecting with the basic human physiology of all of this is really important so that we can actually be ready and able to do the incredibly demanding work that we do. You know, we don't sell soap for a living, and I'm not minimizing that, but that's not what we do. It's crucial. I mean, the folks that we serve, the children we serve, actually need for us to stay healthy and well. Does that make sense?
You know, oh, absolutely. And one of the things I want to kind of touch on, because we've toggled back and forth a little bit between sort of what leaders are doing and the way we're approaching this as employers. And then also importantly, if you're not an employer, you know, what one can do for oneself. And even if you are one, what you can do for yourself. I want to touch for a moment on organizational policy, because I think that, you know, when we spoke previously, we spent quite a bit of time really talking about what do organizations need to do, because it's not all a matter of self-care, right? Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with secondary traumatic stress and burnout and all of those other things, there's the part that you work on your own stuff, mm-hmm. so to speak, but there's also the way that organizational practice makes such a huge difference. And I'm just wondering, you know, you're speaking to a lot of organizational leaders right now on this podcast, and what is your advice to them about some of the very most important things that they can institute, responses that they can have, ways that they can behave, behaviors that they can model for their own team right this moment?
Yeah, I'm very happy to answer that. So I think we've addressed already the basic foundations. I think that's the first part. You know, ensure that you are physically and mentally well, and whatever that means for you, and that you are role modeling that to other people. So if currently your staff are receiving time-sensitive emails at 3 o'clock in the morning, but they're not expected to be on, that sends a powerful message as well of your own dysregulation. And I'm not saying that in a judgmental way. I really think that's important. The other second piece is about expectations. So actually, part of our conversation with Karen Hengartner on Tuesday was really great, because Karen said that she herself recognized that she tends to be someone, when there's a crisis, you know, whether you look at, you know, fight or flight or freeze, she goes into fight mode. Like, that's her natural predisposition. I think a lot of leaders do that. And so Remembering that, you know, just because we're in fight mode, like, let's get this done, you know, we have grant deliverables, let's make sure, you know, the calls are down, this is a good time for you all to catch up on your web-based training, all of that, as well meaning as those things are, we need to also think about and take the temperature of how our staff are functioning and what stage of the game they're at in terms of, you know, first of all, is that how they cope with things? So having flexibility, and it doesn't mean, you know, not having expectations of good quality. Like, I'm not talking about best practice going out the window, but one of the things that I think is really important is to have a dialogue with folks about how they're doing and what they need. So if you don't mind, I'll give an example. I had a call this is where all the days blend together, at some point in the last 10 days with some CAC folks. And, you know, sometimes when I've been doing these, I've been getting leaders saying, well, we have a lot of issues to discuss, so let's not spend too much time on COVID-19. And I don't mean any disrespect to the person who said that, but I was like, that's a mistake, because that's what it's impacting everybody.
Sure.
It doesn't have to necessarily be all we discuss, but I think it's really important to have a time limited, but a check-in, right? Like, just what we all did today before we started recording. It didn't take a long time, but we all had a little chat about, hey, you know, how are you doing today? So I think that when you're having meetings of whatever method you're using, making sure that you can go around and say, you know, see how people are doing so that they feel that that's actually allowed. And then having flexibility about, because people are cognitively a little bit more compromised or challenged right now, having more flexibility about different ways of doing the work. So one member of my team is homeschooling right now. And I said to her, look, she's a hard worker. You know, I trust her 100%. I said, what is the best way for you to get the work done within, you know, making sure you respond to time-sensitive requests? And she said, what would be great is, and then she outlined like an ideal schedule for her right now, so she can also parent. And I was like, that sounds perfect. So having that awareness of the variety of needs that your folks have, and having flexibility and trust that, you know, people are really dedicated and they're really doing the best they can with this.
I'm wondering what you're advising people too about, because what I worry about, honestly, is, you know, I see CAC leaders and their staff feeling very stretched right now, but the tsunami has not hit. The tsunami is when all these kids are back in school and mandated reporters start reporting again, or when all of these kids who have been holed up at home begin to disclose to neighbors and family members and friends once they have contact again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thinking about the fact that this is a marathon and not a sprint, what are you advising people to be thinking of now so that they can be healthy and resilient at the point that they're going to be addressing that tsunami of reports later?
Well, this is why pacing is so important, because as you're saying yourself, if we're kind of focused just in kind of the problem solving mode of the immediate, we're not going to have any fuel left in the tank. And it's actually going to mean that addressing compassion fatigue, secondary trauma, and I want to go back, if you don't mind, to moral injury, because I dropped it earlier, and moral distress. I think that we need to shore up our foundations more than ever before. Right. And what's been interesting, actually, in terms of public perception or willingness to fund certain things, certainly in Canada currently, there's now more funding for mental health services. We Canada has never been very good on funding behavioral health or mental health services at all. And finally, now they're like, huh, this seems like a really important. So we were named an essential service, which would never have happened 6 years ago, I assure you. Right. So there's also, I think, a recognition of psychological and mental health and how crucial that is. So more than ever before, we need to stay connected to all the elements of, you know, what we've discussed, secondary trauma, all of that. The one that is the most challenging and I haven't talked about yet is the concept of moral injury. So moral injury, although it sounds very similar to moral distress, moral injury originally came from the military. And there were circumstances where, because I worked with soldiers for a decade, you know, they would come back from combat and they talked about feeling betrayed or let down by senior leadership, if that makes sense. Like they'd say,
yes,
we saw this, we called for help, nobody came, terrible thing happened as a result. And I'm basically wounded because I feel this breach of trust with my chain of command. And that's also a grief process, right? So one of the pieces I think that we need to really ensure that we're continuing to discuss with one another in our communities of practice, formal or informal, is how are we going to deal with the moral injury that is currently taking place? Because as you say, we know that just because numbers are down doesn't mean it's not happening. And so how do we deal with that part so that when, as you say, the floodgates open again, well, there's several elements there. Will there be funding to support, you know, will we have the resources we need? So that's about advocacy and making sure that we're continuing to ensure that that's true. But how do we also support one another to, because we know it's happening right now. So those are really, they're complex, but I think that we do, we need to shore up the foundations right now. So just to give a silly personal example, but you know, the first week I kind of went into, I don't know, comfort carb eating, you know, like I just kind of went like, wearing my toque every day and wearing, sitting in yoga pants and just eating chocolate chip cookies. And that was actually a perfectly good process for week one. Like I think I needed a lot of self-soothing, not exercising, you know. And finally, after a week, I thought to myself, wait a minute. So first of all, I need to ensure my immune system is strong. So because we're all maybe, you know, affected. So I need to boost my immune system. I need to regain the ability to think clearly. And I need to shore up my fundamental, like all the foundations that allow me, have allowed me to do trauma work for 25 years. I need to ramp those up again. And so I went back to some basics, right? So every day I exercise for, you know, a little bit of time. And I know some of you listening to this, you're like, I have 5 children at home. I can't do that. You know, it doesn't have to be long, but I have brought back some rituals that it's like we threw everything out, that we forgot that we already knew those things. And I feel now that I can think much more clearly than I did, you know, that first week.
When you think about, I think you're touching on some things that are really important because they're so practical. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't take a huge relief effort or a lot of money or even time. Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking about the healthy habits people should be focusing on right now, just back to basics, just as a person. So taking off their CAC director hat or their forensic interviewer hat and just being a human being, what are you advising people to fundamentally focus on right now?
Okay. So I have a little list here.
Because I've been talking about this. I knew you did.
Okay. So let's go back to basics. Number one, we cannot think clearly when we're in survival mode. That is normal. Our brain is preoccupied by the basics, safety, food, shelter, and that is completely normal. Number two, limit your media exposure to once a day and 2 reliable news sources. Don't go down the rabbit hole of bad news. I'm on Facebook only because we have the secondary traumatic stress, you know, the private group on Facebook. I have unfollowed everything else because you know how it goes. Same with Twitter, yeah. right? I don't, those are not actually useful for me. They make me feel anxious and overwhelmed. So I have two reliable news sources, end of story, once a day. Make sure you keep a regular routine with sleep, exercise, healthy meals, all the things that we actually know already, but that we need to go back to. Cut yourself some slack if you're still working, which you are, and not feeling as productive. It is normal that we're not going to be as productive as in under usual circumstances, and there's real neurophysiology and neurobiology to explain that. Two more things. Lower your standards about homeschooling if you have children at home. Your kids need love, reassurance, and support more than going through worksheets and rainbow charts. They need schedule as well. Connect with other people. Reach out to family and friends when you're having a bad day. We know social support is key to managing this for ourselves, right? And finally, focus on what you can control. I always go back to Stephen Covey's Circles of Control and Influence. There's so many elements right now that are outside of our control. There are things every single day that we can do. So the last piece I want to say about that is really recognizing two things, rumination and fortune telling. So rumination, as many of you know, is, you know, really chewing over past things that have happened that we can no longer change. And we're like grinding them, right? Thinking about, you know, coulda, shoulda, woulda, I'm so mad at this person. Like it's very not productive at all, but catching ourselves when we do that. And fortune telling is, you know, a gift of the anxious people, right? Fortune telling is thinking in the future about things, worst case scenario of what might happen. I catch myself doing this because I tend to be an anxious person unless I take really good care of myself. And I caught myself even this morning. I was like, oh my gosh, in 3 days, what if this happens? What if, and finally I was like, wait a minute. And instead I took my cup of coffee. I opened, you know, my window and I looked at my bird feeder and I was like, I'm just going to focus on right this minute, like this cup of coffee, bird feeder, just to reset myself, because there's so many aspects of this pandemic we can't control, but we can control our responses and the ways that we take care of ourselves and one another.
Well, and I think that one of the things that you're pointing out is the benefit of just being present for it, you know, and present with each other and present with our loved ones and how comforting that is. While you were talking, I was thinking of this week I sat down and my family celebrates Easter. And so I sat down and wrote Easter cards to a bunch of my loved ones. And in it, I was reflecting on past, you know, joyful Easters, not in a sad way at all, but just, you know, I remember growing up and having a new Easter dress and how fun it was to have the Easter egg hunt. And I think that it was the opposite of rumination. You know what I mean? It was an opportunity to reflect on something positive. And not to be Pollyanna-ish, but it actually did make me feel better. And I thought, you know, this opportunity for reflection, we can also sort of choose to turn it away from, you know, all the unknown bad things that would happen to times of past strength and positivity. And while it's not going to cure everything, I will tell you that in a moment, it made me feel more like I could competently handle the next moment. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to feeling sort of undermined or anxious about what that next moment might hold. So I think this is going to just really teach us a lot about our own, you know, whether you have formal mindfulness practice or not, I think it's going to teach us that same lesson about being present. Maybe.
I could not agree with you more. No, I agree with you so much because, like, again, we know the literature on resilience, right? We know about post-traumatic growth. It's like we forgot about pieces. And I love the example you're giving because it's also about reconnecting with, you know, the things that have, you know, that shore us up, reconnecting with the things that we have currently available to us that you're right. You know, and I think we're pretty clear, you and I, that we're not both saying, you know, this is great and we're living our best life.
Oh no.
But we are having roller coasters also. And that's also okay. But self-awareness. And, you know, if you don't mind, I know we're running out of time, but I want to give you one last quick example of an experience I had yesterday. So I don't do a lot of media interviews because you know how the messaging isn't always, you know, anyways, it's not always
accurate.
Yeah. So anyway, so, but this was a very brief, like a little radio spot on some something yesterday. And what was so striking to me is that the journalist who interviewed me was incredibly dysregulated herself. Like she was, you know, my friend calls it, you know, she had flipped her lid. Like she was out of her window of tolerance. Mm. She was very alarmed. She was very dramatic. She was really quite catastrophic, you know, like she was just not in a great space. And I was thinking about, first of all, although I was irritated by, you know, the messaging she was sending out and whatever, that was a whole other thing. But I actually also had a moment of real compassion for her because I listened to her and I thought, you are so dysregulated right now. Like you are not feeling good at all, but you're also a communicator. And what impact are you having on your listeners right now? Right? This contagion effect of having a false sense of calm, because I hate that, just like any of you, I'm sure you've met times who pretend they're balanced, but they're actually really the most angry people you've ever met with a calm voice, you know. I really thought about this journalist right now is out of her window of tolerance, and she isn't self-aware, she's not present. And so I really think that it's a way to just be able to like shore ourselves up and be stronger so that we can deal with whatever the heck is coming at us. Cause I can't tell the future either, you know?
You know, I think this has been such a helpful conversation. I know our listeners are going to appreciate it so much. So I really appreciate you taking the time for us while in the middle of a pandemic to have this conversation. Is there any question that you wish I had asked you that I didn't?
I feel like actually one last one. Let's talk a little bit about resources before we sign off. Does that sound good?
Yes, yes, okay. Absolutely.
And before I talk about resources, I just want to say, Teresa, the CAC world is, I always am so delighted to be able to offer resources. Thank you all for the work that you do. I really mean that. And it's, for me, this, what gives me fulfillment right now is being able to deliver and develop free resources for folks, because I truly, truly, really believe in the work that you do, and I so appreciate it. So let's talk about resources before we're done. So I heard a great comment a couple of days ago. Someone said to me, the resources coming at us is like trying to drink from a fire hose right now, right? Like, like I had my credit card company email me about like self-care resources. And I was like, thanks. Thanks, Amex, you know. I think that it can get a little overwhelming given how everything we've discussed today, that we're busy, we're overwhelmed. So one of the things that we put together, and I've actually, as you know, Teresa, sent them to you already. These are all free resources and we've put them together. They are specific to secondary trauma and high trauma exposed environments. So they're really geared towards you. And places that are providing really great resources right now are the Secondary Traumatic Stress Consortium, the think tank that I belong to. We've put together some free resources there. And you're going to see really good stuff coming out of NCTSN and SAMHSA right now. And so if you're feeling overloaded with strategies and suggestions, just go to those sources, because they're going to be really geared towards you and the work that you do. And I think that it's really great to make a commitment, you know, to connect with some of those things on a regular basis. The final thing I'll say is, if you're not seeing a resource that, you know, really fits your needs because you're in such a specialized work environment, contact us and we will do our best to put it together for you. We're very happy to do that. That's what we're here to do right now. So just get in touch with TEND. And we'll explore if we can, you know, design a resource for you folks.
Thank you so much. I know these resources will be tremendously beneficial, and we'll make sure that they're added not only to our COVID-19 page on NCA Engage, but also to the podcast detail information that we have available in Buzzsprout and that people can access whenever they access this podcast episode. So thank you again, Françoise. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And I just wish, you know, you and your loved ones continued good health.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Teresa.
Thank you for listening to 1 in 10. We hope you'll tune in for our next episode when we'll talk with Stacey LeBlanc from the UP Institute about why spanking persists in our culture despite decades of research demonstrating its ineffectiveness.
and what organizations can do to positively change that culture. For more information about National Children's Alliance and the work of Children's Advocacy Centers, visit our website at www.nationalchildrensalliance.org.